Boobies, boobies, boobies. Booby, 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 booby. Booby, 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 boo. Woody Allen, booby.
All right, all you movie junkies. It is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome, one and all, to episode 67 of the SLS Cast. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Easter Island episode of the SLS Cast. Now, you're thinking to yourself, wait, you're talking about those funny little stone statue head things? That is exactly what I am talking about, because, as it turns out, oral traditions have it that either Hotu Matua or Tu'u Koto, Ko'iho, I'm sorry, the legendary founders of Rapa Nui, or as we know it, Easter Island, brought 67 tablets from their homeland. And on that nonsensical bullshit, I am Matt.
What were the tablets?
I don't know. I just know that there were 67 of them.
Well, people are going to wonder. People are going to ask. And so, yeah, I mean, they could have been like, I don't know, like for back pain. Or, I don't know, for
not
constipation.
Tablets.
Tablets.
I guess you're thinking, you know, some people might call them caplets, and some people call them tablets. But yeah, I hear you. I go either way on that. Yes. And who are you, by the way?
I'm Tim. Tim.
Very good.
The asker of questions. The demander of answers.
Indeed. Indeed.
What tablets
how the hell are
do you
think? Sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right. Having some fun and coming back, you know, getting back to the grind after spring break and everything. And of course, here we are. It's merely the Tuesday after the last time we spoke. So here we are, the 18th of March, you know, past the Ides of March, as it were. Trying to get back into the flow of school. Had a disastrous Spanish test, but...
Oh, no habla español?
Apparently not.
Yeah?
Matter of fact, what'd you just say?
Yeah. I mean, are you good at... I mean, like, is that something that you can catch on to pretty quick? Or do you actually have to work at it?
My problem isn't so much that... Yeah, I mean, I can follow along from the book. I have a basic grasp of, you know, thing, but I just can't seem to be able to pull it all together because I don't really have any way to practice it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the hold up. Not to mention, in the last 3 weeks, not including spring break, of course, in the last 3 weeks, we had three different professors because our initial professor had to drop out because it was going to screw up his retirement.
Oh.
And then the person they got to replace him said, I don't know, I guess I can't handle it or something, and then poof, gone. So we come back the Tuesday before spring break when we're supposed to have a test on a chapter. And this lady's like, yeah, we're going to wait till after spring break because I don't even know what the hell's going on yet. So, yeah, it turned out to be a lot of fun. And I'm just kind of writing off this particular section. We'll see how it goes from here. I'm sure it'll be fine before it's all said and done. But, yeah.
Huh.
Other than that, I mean... Yeah, it's been kind of just regular standard honky-dory.
Honky-dory? I thought it was hunky-dory.
Yeah, honky.
Did you say honky?
You know, like white folk. Yeah. Right, white folk, honky. Frozen came out today on Blu-ray and DVD.
Yeah, you know they're still showing that at movie theaters, too.
I know, and so I had pre-ordered it on Amazon, so that came in today. And I got to do that as an early birthday present for my daughter, who's turning 4 on the 28th. And she was, oh my gosh, you should have seen. Everybody was really excited because the other girls love Frozen as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just as excited that my redhead got it as as if they had gotten it themselves. And then they watched it tonight and while I was at class.
And
so thankfully
watch
I didn't
it
have
tomorrow
to see
night,
it, and that was good.
And they're going to watch it tonight after that.
Indeed, indeed. Well. But I do have something kind of interesting that I found that I thought would be interesting to share.
Yeah, do it.
All right, so everyone has heard of the console wars and how they continually go on, except most people today consider the console war to be between Microsoft and Sony.
Oh, the Xbox One is better. Oh, the PS4 is better. Oh, fuck Kinect. Oh, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And most people have just pretty much dismissed the Wii U based on the name, the Wii U. And while I own a Wii U, and apparently myself and one other person owns a Wii U, I enjoy my Wii U, and I think it's fun. However, as the only person apparently who does enjoy their Wii U,
Oh, that sounds silly. Was kind of... I'm sure there are hundreds of millions of other guys out there who do enjoy their own Wii U.
I mean, I know lots of people like to play with their Wii U, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, but Nintendo has actually taken some losses and stuff over the last couple of years. And, I mean, the Wii U just has not done the business that they had been wanting to do and everything, which is fine. So they had an article here on GamesRadar.com. This is courtesy of Matt Cundy. C-U-N-D-Y. So I did the best that I could with that last name.
Yeah.
And it turns out that Nintendo is fine. Nintendo can lose money literally for like the next 38 years without even worrying about anything. They have $10.5 billion in the bank, which means they could lose $257 million a year until 2052. Then after that, they still have $6 billion in premises, equipment, and investments, which would carry them to the year 2075 before they were truly flat broke. And then they still haven't touched their IPs. And yeah, so don't worry about Nintendo. They've got 30, 40, 50 years to figure out what the hell they're going to do and make it work. So don't worry about Nintendo. I just thought that was kind of funny.
Here's the thing about the Wii U, is that, is it like a Nintendo requirement for the animation to not, like, be 3D? As in, not at least try to make it look like that you've improved the animation and technology? Or is it, like Nintendo and, like, you know, like the Wii U stuff, just based on how fun it is to play, not necessarily the graphics? Because, like, I played is bowling, and it's like I'm playing the same bowling game that I play maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, like at an arcade or something.
Okay, well, this is actually interesting that you should bring this up, because this is actually part of the problem.
Oh.
By simply adding the letter U to the end, nobody realized that it was even a new console. It is a complete brand new console. It is actually, strictly speaking, only on graphics horsepower alone, actually better than a 360 or a PS4. Now, when you factor in RAM and CPU and all that kind of stuff, it's basically about as good. But mere graphical power, it is indeed a little bit better than a PS3 or a 360. So people don't even realize that. So all the games are 1080p now. I mean, they're full on up there, and they've got that stuff. So that was number one. By calling it a Wii U, people just thought it was some kind of an add-on or something that was just basically related to the Wii. They did that because they wanted to keep all that motion control stuff that had been so popular with the Wii, and they didn't want to have people buy a whole bunch of brand new peripherals, so they wanted everybody to be able to use their actual Wii remotes or the Wiimotes. God, would you like to play with my Wiimote? Anyway.
It shakes.
It's got built-in vibration, and so they wanted to have all. So I guess that was why they did it. Then, of course, they had the gamepad, and the gamepad was a brilliant idea. It's where you have, it's kind of like the smart glass integration for the 360,
mm-hmm.
where you can take your smart glass, your Asus or whatever tablet, and then integrate it with your 360 and kind of have a map on there, whatever, and play your games. So they had that built in as the controller. And the problem was is that they're like, wow, well, that's really neat, but nobody really has anything that they want to do with it. And with it being the only controller, it's like, well, what am I supposed to do with this thing? Because the battery dies because the screen is on. And even Nintendo has finally conceded the point, because I got Donkey Kong Country, Tropical Freeze, and when you go to play it, you tell them you're using the gamepad, and then the screen just turns off. So even Nintendo's given up at this point. So it's not that it is an actual good gaming system, and they did have some really good ideas. It was just really bad implementation and no third-party support for it. Consequently, all the really, really good games are these badass Mario games, amazing Zelda's games, and then, of course, things like Donkey Kong and Pikmin and what have you. And that's the thing. So that's where you get people who are like, oh, well, I mean, all I know is the bowling game from back in 2006 or whatever it was. And no, it's so much more than that now. But unfortunately, neither here nor there.
So I experienced my first earthquake yesterday morning. That was exciting.
Do tell.
Well, okay. Have you ever ridden in a manual vehicle?
Of course.
It's like the gray area between stalling out and actually being able to accelerate, where that gray area kind of consists of like sudden jolting and it feels like your engine and your transmission is just about to explode.
Correct. Sure.
That is what an earthquake, at least that is what a 4.4 earthquake feels like.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's
the last earthquake I was in was above a 5.
How was that? Was that like 3 manual cars?
It was literally like 20 years ago up in Washington. I was actually on the phone with this friend of mine, and I was trying to stay on her good side because I really liked her friend. Her friend was hot, and it turned out that her friend liked me, so I was, you know, trying to work that connection. And we're talking, and I'm like, and my parents were at the movie theater, so I'm of course stuck babysitting the siblings, and we're on the phone, and all of a sudden I see that the picture on the wall in the hallway is starting to shake, and I'm like, what's going on? Who's shaking my bed? But I'm thinking that my sisters have literally started pounding something down on the ground, and then it doesn't dawn on me right away until the girl on the phone, she's like, holy shit, it's an earthquake. And she's like, I gotta go. And so she hangs up, and I'm like, wow, shit, we really are having an earthquake. And the whole house was like shaking like completely horizontally. And so I jumped up into the doorway and then told all my brothers and sisters, get in a doorway. And so they did, and then lasted, I don't know, 15 seconds total, maybe. And that was about it. So then we checked, you know, and a couple of plates had fallen off the counter or something. And it was fun, though. It was really exciting. And
Until the floor opens and you plummet to your death.
Yeah. And then my stepdad, who had been at the mall, at the movie theater, he said that the entire... He watched the entire floor of the mall just completely shift, almost like in place. Like the carpet just started shifting away from the walls in place. It was really kind of creepy, he said.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, I don't know, it was like a 5.1 or 5.2 or something like that. Well, wasn't then, much bigger than yours.
Just you wait. There's a good chance that me being able to one-up that story would be when the entire city of LA crumbles, and I am one-upping you as I'm coming back.
Dude, you'll be
you.
Able. I mean, you'll be all over that. Are you kidding? And be like, you're gonna just call me, hey Matt. Guess what? I'm in a fucking serious earthquake now, bitch. What are you gonna do now?
Hey, listen to this.
San Andreas fault, bitch. Hey, yeah. But I'm glad that you survived. I'm glad it wasn't very scary and that it was just a minor one. It's good to break you in on the tremors.
Really. Yeah, I mean, it was like 6:25 in the morning. So it woke me from a dead sleep, and it was just one of those things where like I woke up and I thought, God, it felt and sounded like a car like hit the apartment, drove through the apartment. It was bizarre. I don't hear any sirens or anything, and I just went back to sleep. So I wasn't having to yell at people to get in a doorway like you, but who knows?
Right on.
Maybe next time.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, okay, I think we have definitely dragged on the mundane existence of our lives long enough. Shall we go ahead and segue into the news?
Ooh,
do that segue thing.
All right, here we go. They see me rolling. No, it's okay. Anyway. The news! We'll be right back. news. Do you want to go first? Do you want me to go first? Or what do you want?
I'll go first.
Go for it, sir.
Alrighty, so Star Wars Episode 7 is to begin filming in May during the Disney's annual shareholders meeting in Portland, Oregon. Walt Disney CEO Bob Iger had this to say: that there will be some very familiar faces along with a trio of new leads in the new Star Wars movie. So we don't know who it is. It could, you know, it could be Han Solo, it could be Mark Hamill, it could only be Carrie Fisher, or maybe it's in addition to these guys, because everybody already knows that, you know, those three are definitely going to be in that movie. He also went on to say that rumor has it that almost every actor in the world has been cast in this movie. But so far, the official cast member that we've confirmed, the only one, is R2-D2. End quote. I guess they cast the midget to fit in there? No, I'm kidding. It's all robotics now. But anyways, the movie is set for a December 18th, 2015 release. And it is actually shooting in London at Pinewood Studios, or the famous Pinewood Studios. Yeah, that's pretty much it on that. I mean, yeah.
Right on. I can't wait to see. Maybe we'll get lucky, and R2-D2 is just going to roll on screen and then just break.
Just tip over.
We won't have to worry about him anymore and figure out why the fuck he's got jets and a fucking Swiss Army goddamn kit inside his belly and all this fucking bullshit and in the prequels. And then he has nothing in the main series. And yeah, so maybe we'll figure out all that. I don't know.
Are there any like additional characters that you would like to see in the movie?
I think as long as they can, I don't know, tastefully is not the right word, but legitimately place Han and Leia and Luke, even if it's just for cameos and stuff, for cameo purposes only, but if they can, as long as they can truly legitimately place them, that'll do it for me. I'll be fine after that. I don't need to see anybody else. I mean, you know, any of the supporting cast. Shit, Admiral Akbar would be fun. You know, it's a trap. Or Lando Calrissian or whatever. Yeah, they'd all be good. I don't care. But it's the holy trinity of characters, if you will.
Unless maybe
as long as they can legitimately place them, I'm good.
Well, yeah. I hope they don't throw in like those really a really stupid line for those characters to have, like General Akbar. He'd dramatically turn to the camera and say, "It's still a trap." Just like an obvious kind of, they would think, is a witty tip to the hat to the audience and to the original series. But no, that would absolutely ruin it. But something tells me that that won't happen, so I'm actually really looking forward to the movie.
Me too. And since we're on Star Wars news, I guess I'll lead in with Esquire.com, courtesy of Jeremy Singer, the Lost Star Wars movie. This is actually a really cool story on the story behind the story of the short film that George Lucas commissioned for Empire Strikes Back, which is finally seeing the light of day again. And I really like how this one starts. It says, "We live in a world that's thought to have consumed every piece of material from the Star Wars franchise. But chances are, you haven't heard of Black Angel. Probably because it was lost for over 3 decades. And it was a short film that was meant to accompany The Empire Strikes Back in theaters back then, all the way up through the late 70s in the United States, and even up through roughly the mid 80s in Europe. They would have shorts. They'd have short films and stuff that would precede your main show, much like when you go and see a Pixar movie today and you get the animated short ahead of time. Well, they would have something akin to that, but it was usually live action. And they had done that for Star Wars and for New Hope. And then they wanted to do the same thing for Empire Strikes Back. And then they got there and they ended up posting it. It didn't make it to the United States audiences because by the time Empire Strikes Back hits the theaters, U.S. studios aren't doing that anymore. But they did play it in the U.K. And unfortunately, shortly after this thing gets done, it's lost. And they still are not really even sure how it got lost and found, but it was definitely truly lost. Roger Christian, the man behind the film, he says that he had an original negative and a print copy of the film, and he kept it at the London's Boss Film Studios. However, the studio went bankrupt in the 1990s while he was out of town on a shoot, and they ended up throwing his belongings away. So then...
Oh God, I'd be so pissed.
Yeah, so then he's writing a book. So he's writing a book, and he decides to check with Fox to see if they have any. But then he learns that all of the copies that they had been thrown out as well after the Film Element Storage Facility, the former UK Studio Rank, had shut down in the same decade. Lucasfilm Archives couldn't even locate their copy either. And so poor Roger Christian assumes that everything is just gone forever. Interestingly, though, in December 2011, he gets a call from an archivist at Universal Studios in Los Angeles. And he says, quote, "It was out of the blue. I had to confirm who I was and that I was the director." And the man said, "Well, I've got a negative," end quote. And he's still confused even now how his property, which was distributed by Fox, ended up at Universal. So, long story short, after 33 years, this just amazing movie. And it's not like science fiction. This is, you know, fantasy and you know, knights and armor and all that kind of stuff. After 33 years, Black Angel returned to theaters last October, and they are now looking at trying to release it through iTunes or Netflix, possibly even as part of a re-release of future editions of The Empire Strikes Back. I would just be very happy to see that. You can actually get lots of portions of it, possibly even piece together the whole thing on YouTube if you're so inclined. So you can check that out. The article is at Esquire.com. The film is called Black Angel from 1979, and yeehaw.
Very cool. Yeah, I remember talking about that back in October, so I'm glad to hear that they're trying to release it for home viewings. All right, so Lena Dunham, the girl star, or she's the star of the popular series Girls, I think it's on HBO. She recently, while as recent as the Academy Awards, or actually no, I think it was the Golden Globe Awards, when she came out and publicly addressed that she sided with Dylan Farrow when Dylan Farrow was accusing her father, Woody Allen, of molesting her at a young age. And Lena Dunham was taking the side of Dylan Farrow. Well, it turns out that on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, in which Lena Dunham was a guest, she had this to say. Quote, "In the latest Woody Allen debate, I'm decidedly pro-Dylan Farrow and decidedly disgusted with Woody Allen's behavior. But for me, when people go through his work and comb through it for references to child molestation, that's not the fucking point. I'm not going to indict the work. I think that you can decide that you don't want to support the work of somebody who has molested a child. That's a completely appropriate choice. But going through it and saying, look, he's told us in 57 ways that he rapes kids, that's not the thing. The thing is to look at the actual evidence that exists in the world, which I think strongly suggests that Woody Allen is in the wrong. But for me, the point is not go through his one-act plays looking for references to child molestation, because I'm not comfortable living in a world where art is part of how we convict people of crimes," end quote. And obviously, other than strongly still supporting Dylan Farrell and kind of crapping all over Woody Allen, she's just saying not to use art as an excuse of crapping all over Woody Allen, I guess. Because all these people have went back and watched all of his movies and pulled out different scenes where in the background there were, it, like, visible was like a word, like child molestation or raping and just stuff like that. And there's like these hidden things throughout his movies where people are using that against him, like things that they read or see inadvertently, like in the background and stuff, or even in the dialogue. But at the same time, she's saying that there is this evidence, there is this obvious evidence to use instead of looking back at his movies that we can use against him, that it's obviously this evidence proves. However, she mentions all this other stuff about going back in his movies even though it says rape and that he molests children, that he's a completely bigoted asshole who did this, and that, you know, even though that all that is there, we shouldn't use it against him. But there is other hard evidence, and she doesn't list that other hard evidence. I strike that a little strange, especially not like really supporting the other half of it. Half of it. Maybe I'm just reading into it too much.
I'm going to go back to the op-ed that he wrote back in, I guess, January, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to lean on that. I mean, the guy has been proven in a court of law with multiple investigations and everything like that. So I've got to lean towards the state did the job the right way the first time. I got to believe that that's the case.
Yeah, and Scarlett Johansson actually came out with a statement just recently, I think within the past week, it might have even been a few days ago, saying pretty much that same thing. It's like, I have no room to judge, because Dylan Farrow singled out, like, Louis C.K., Kate Blanchett, Scarlett Johansson, as basically just saying that how could these people protect Woody Allen? So Scarlett Johansson was really excited or intrigued by the idea that she was singled out among these other actors.
This is coming to us from SlashFilm.com, courtesy of Peter Skirreta. The Incredibles 2 and another Cars sequel is in development at Pixar. It's not much, it's just a blurb at this point, but Disney head Bob Iger dropped a big piece of news offhandedly during the Disney investors meeting today, stating that Brad Bird is working on the story for The Incredibles 2 and that Pixar is also working on a new Cars movie. And I don't really give a flying fuck at this point about a Cars sequel. They had their chance and blew it. Although you liked it. And I, however, am just so ecstatic at the true prospect of another Incredibles movie. I've been waiting for this for many, many years. Yes. And in the same news of tie-ins and sequels and what have yous, courtesy of GameSpot.com, Sony is making a Last of Us movie. It turns out that Naughty Dog creative director Neil Druckmann is set to write the script, and Spider-Man director Sam Raimi is attached to the project, but in only a mystery capacity. They're not sure what his role or involvement with the project is actually going to be. And despite what you might think about video game adaptations, the story behind this is just so amazingly compelling and so awesome that it's right up there for me with the incredible sequel. I'm just very excited to see this, and hopefully they will just simply do it justice. That is all I had on those fronts there, sir.
Cool. Darren Aronofsky's Noah is set to be released this month, I think, and in the next couple weeks here. That's a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what side of the religious spectrum you are towards movies. And this is from an article from cinemablend.com entitled Paramount significantly alters Noah's marketing without consulting Darren Aronofsky. Paramount and the filmmakers have been actively trying to seek, I guess, approval from various religious groups, and they got it from some of them, and they were denied it by a number of them. And there was even speculation that came out saying that they went to the Pope to try to get the Pope to watch the movie so they'd get his approval, and he completely denied. And actually, the past couple days, Paramount came back saying, "Oh no, he didn't deny it. The Pope didn't deny it." But however, unlike the last Pope, I can kind of see this current Pope maybe sitting in the movie theater drinking a St. Pauli's girl and eating some popcorn, watching Noah on the big screen. And I kind of wonder, like, if the Paramount got to screen this movie for them, I mean, would they do it in the Vatican? And if so, would they do it in a very lush and lavish movie theater with Dolby Atmos surround sound and in 3D goggles or 3D glasses? Or would it be more of like a modest screening, you know, just in his great hall where he watches it, you know, in a little TV that was made back in the 1970s and, you know, with rabbit ears and all that stuff? From that article I originally was talking about, Paramount significantly alters Noah's marketing without consulting Darren Aronofsky, this is what the article has to say. It was never going to be easy to make a movie like Noah. It's hard enough that you're asking a studio to throw down nine figures for a biblical story as the Christian dollar is sought by Hollywood, but still relatively untested. And this amount is being entrusted to Darren Aronofsky, a candid indie filmmaker who scored maybe the flukiest $300 million hit in the strange, big, sexy Black Swan. It's not a surprise that there's been strife behind the scenes, as Aronofsky is famously pickly with a distinct vision all of his own. And now it looks like the studio's getting a mild case of cold feet in regards to the $120 million budgeted Noah. The rap claims that early on, Paramount and Aronofsky agreed to market to those of Christian faith without pandering or making excuses, urging them to open their minds to an unusual interpretation to a beloved story. Instead, Paramount did not consult with the director and honored the wishes of the national religious broadcasters by labeling ads and promotional material with this message. The film is inspired by the story of Noah. While artistic license has been taken, we believe that this film is true to the essence, values, and integrity of a story that is a cornerstone of faith for millions of people worldwide. The biblical story of Noah can be found in the book of Genesis. End quote. And end all quotes. So, okay, so they do this little ad thing for those of, for the religious groups. Now, if you were dedicated to, you know, religion, to the book of, to the Bible, the holy book, wouldn't you already know that where to find the story of Noah in the burning bush and all that? Yeah, I mean, they would obviously know Genesis. So not only do they, Paramount, feel inspired to have this message for this group, they're, I think if it's for that group, they're pointing out the obvious completely. You know, I don't know. It just, it doesn't make sense.
I've given up on all this. they win. I'm going to go see the movie. And at this point, I think they're pulling this shit just so people will talk about it and just so people will go and see the movie. I think that it's really, everything is just simply calculated moves by Paramount to ensure that people are keeping the movie on the brain so that they'll go check it out one way or the other. Because if you go and you buy a ticket and you watch the movie and you hate it, they still got their money. Just as much as if you go to the movie and you like it.
Exactly.
But back to happier news. From therap.com, courtesy of Jeff Snyder, Idris Elba to voice Killer Tiger in Jon Favreau's Jungle Book for Disney. That's right. Move over, Richard Parker. Disney has found the perfect actor to voice the Killer Tiger Shere Khan in Jon Favreau's The Jungle Book, as Idris Elba is nearing a deal. Did I just say Idris Elba? Wow.
You did.
I'm channeling my inner John Travolta. Okay. Idris Elba is nearing a deal to star in the live-action movie. An individual familiar with the project has told The Wrap. Disney's Jungle Book movie, which was written by Justin Marks, will be a mix of live-action and VFX. The studio is in a race with Warner Brothers to bring Rudyard Kipling's classic tale to the big screen. Warner Brothers' projects suffered a setback when Alejandro González Iñárritu bowed out. That's it.
All right, so The Queen of Versailles, we watched this documentary and reviewed it here a couple weeks ago on the show. It's that documentary about the Westgate downfall, I guess. The movie was touted as a from rags to riches story. I don't know that way. You know what I mean. They start off poor, they get rich, and then they're poor again. And apparently, the Westgate owner himself, when he first saw that little tagline, he got pissed off, and he sued a defamation lawsuit. He sued the filmmaker, even though in the movie he actually says that this is a rags to riches back to rags story, something like that. And this is from a Hollywood Reporter article entitled Queen of Versailles, Filmmaker Beats Westgate's Defamation Claim. They say that, having viewed the supposedly rigorous portions of the motion picture numerous times, the arbitrator simply does not find that any of the content of the motion picture was false. The lawsuit was brought by Siegel's Westgate Resorts on the precipice of the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. The film focuses on Siegel's commissioning of a $75 million Florida mansion for himself before the economy went south. Siegel wasn't happy that the press release for the film described a timeshare tycoon and his socialite wife being forced to sell off the unfinished property or face economic truth and a rags-to-riches-to-rags story. Knowing that a filmmaker-friendly forum like IFTA or IFTA wouldn't be too kind to him, Siegel fought like hell to keep his defamation claims in federal court. But last year, a judge ruled Greenfield attained a proper release from those at Westgate Resorts who participated in the filming. As such, the matter went to arbitration. Greenfield spent 2 years making the lauded documentary that was distributed in theaters by Magnolia Films and televised by Bravo and CNBC. During this time, Siegel and his family made themselves available for extensive interviews and said things they might be regretting. And the article goes on from there. Very interesting. If you guys are interested, just totally check it out. All these, like, copywriting and defamation and, you know, suing, saying that, you know, like, if whatever you do as a background actor is within your own copyright. It's just interesting, just all how all this just kind of happens.
Well, all right. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the news here with this last piece that I've got here from Cineblend.com, courtesy of Mac Rodden. Barkhad Abdi is an Academy Award nominee, and he has no money at all. It's very, very sad. Here's the deal. Basically, he was paid $65,000 for Captain Phillips, which seems about right since it was his first role in the major players at the top. Took payroll cuts to keep the budget around $50 million or so. That's a nice chunk of change to live off of, but considering the movie was filmed 2 years ago, it's not a surprise it hasn't lasted, especially since Abdi quit his job as a mobile phone salesman when the film came out. Yeah. That's kind of rough. So this is just a quick little article here. It talks about just how, you know, people who have suddenly found fame and fortune and are actually nominated for prestigious awards and all that kind of stuff don't exactly all live the high life. Yeah. He actually even had to wear a borrowed tux to go to the Oscars. Kind of rough.
He is doing another movie now, isn't he? Or he's cast in a movie that's...
Well, yeah, it says that he has gotten onto the marathon running drama, The Place That Hits the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And he is also reportedly reading plenty of scripts to find some roles moving forward. And I'm sure he'll get, you know, additional opportunities through that. Maybe not like, you know, the Tom Hanks style money, but maybe that he'll be able to buy his own clothing going forward. I mean, that's got to be kind of rough. You go and you do this fantastic movie, and the day the movie comes out, people are like, man, you look just like that guy I saw the movie, and he's out there trying to sell you a, you know, get you to buy a cell phone. And fickle Hollywood. Hollywood is fickle.
No.
I know.
No.
But yes, that's it. That's all I got.
Alrighty, well, that's all I have.
Outstanding. Well, then let's jump right into the next segment, folks. It is, of course, the return of Three Square. Yes, Three Squared. Okay, so we are revisiting a previous Three Squared. This is the first time that we have done this in the history of the show. We are going back
milestones
for another round of controversial movies. Now, previously, we did this actually just a little over a year ago, back from March 3rd of 2013. And I had actually picked Birth of a Nation from 1915, Song of the South from 1946, and the seminal I Spit on Your Grave from 1978. Tim, of course, chose the touching, moving Cannibal Holocaust from 1980.
Yeah, with Meryl Streep.
Along with the shocking, for its time, Bonnie and Clyde from 1967, which, if you don't remember from that previous episode, the project was not so highly thought of, and they actually said, hey, Warren Beatty, you can have 40% of the gross. Last but not least for Tim was Monty Python's Life of Brian from 1979. And then, of course, this is back from the era when we actually had a third host. And good old Mikey, at the time, picked Surrealist from 1929, Kids from 1995, and Irreversible from 2002. Now that we've done that little flash through time, we're going to go and do our new segments. And in keeping with the idea that we, last time we did, where we wanted to make sure we could come back to this segment, we want to be able to, you know, triple dip, as it were. So we chose movies last time that were from three specific decades so that we could kind of keep the pickings. And this time, I tried to keep a similar theme. All of my movies have come from one decade. The 90s. The fabulous 90s. And coming to us from 22 years ago, back in March, first up, Basic Instinct. March 1992, the American erotic thriller film, directed by Paul Verhoeven. Starring, of course, Michael Douglas and the seminal role of Sharon Stone. Which is, of course, about a chick who writes a book about a serial killer, and then a serial killer is busting out murdering people in the style of her books. This, of course, was controversial not only for its subject matter, but for its very seriously overt sex that was involved with lesbian kissing. I'm sorry, did I say that? Lesbifriends. And all the wonderful things that go into that. And then there was the fantabulous, gratuitous beaver shot, as was parodied in Loaded Weapon 1. This movie did amazing amounts of money, based primarily on its controversial status. The movie itself was not... terrible, I guess, but it wasn't exactly great. Critical response to this movie was indeed mixed. And it's really interesting because you can really go back and see the whole did it age well thing like we did from last week, and you can really revisit it with this movie. Yeah. It's an interesting flick and definitely controversial for its day. Next up for me, Reservoir Dogs. This one, of course, is from October of 1992. And this is the American crime film that is the before and after of a robbery. And this specific robbery is a diamond heist that goes wrong. And, of course, this was directed and written by Quentin Tarantino. Commonly known for putting, even though he did True Romance and everything there beforehand, this is pretty much the movie that is tied to putting him on the map. And yes, people are like, well, what about Pulp Fiction? This is how he got Pulp Fiction, was this movie. Starring, of course, Harvey Keitel, Tim Roth, Chris Penn, Steve Buscemi, Lawrence Tierney, and Michael Madsen in the creepiest fucking role ever. This is one of the most violent movies ever in the history of movies. And anyone who says otherwise, I defy you to prove how this is not one of the most violent, not the most violent movies, but one of the most violent movies. And which is what makes it so controversial. There is just no denying that the penultimate scene where Michael Madsen does what he does to that poor bastard cop, and I'm not going to spoil it. You can go and watch that or YouTube the scene or whatever. That is one of the first times in my growing up, in my formative years, when I can honestly say to myself, I went, and I mean, I don't do that very often. And that I was like, holy crap. Yeah. So feel free to check it out. It's loaded with amazing, amazing one-liners and tons of quotables. Not to mention, you have Stephen Wright as a radio DJ for Where the Sounds of the 70s Survived. Fantastic movie. Fantastic movie. I highly recommend you check it out. And last but not least, on the list here is Crash from 1996. This is the Canadian-British psychological thriller written and directed by David Cronenberg. And this is based on J.G. Ballard's 1973 novel of the same name. And this, of course, is kind of a combination of the previous two films, where one is about the controversy regarding sex, the other is about the controversy regarding violence. Well, here they decided to do both. Let's fuck in an NC-17 setting while purposely crashing a car so that we can have all sorts of violence and accidents and sex all at the same time. What makes this so interesting is the starring roles going to people like James Spader and Holly Hunter. You wouldn't think you would see someone or people like that in positions like that with body parts exposed like that. But you can and you do. Welcome to Hollywood in the 90s. This movie is really not very good at all. In my opinion, it's got a mixed reception. It's just shy of fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. So there are people who thought that it did have some value. I would say that it's great for the Skinamax following from when you're a kid. So if you know anybody who is in that age group and you feel comfortable exposing them to whacking material, masturbatory aids, then please expose them to this film. So once again, my picks for the controversial movies, all from the decade of the 90s, are Basic Instinct from March of 1992, Reservoir Dogs from October of 92, and Crash from 1996.
My three movies, actually, it turns out that they do have something in common, so they can actually be put into a category to fit in to this the theme of things with this three squared. And my three movies all feature a woman getting penetrated by something. That is right. Matt was from the 1970s. Mine feature women getting penetrated by something. So that's going to be the real twist.
Mine was from the 1990s.
Oh, really? Well, it was... Yeah, whatever. Okay. So... God, Matt. We'll fix it in post-production. My first movie is from 1929, and it is the silent surrealist short film entitled Un Chien Andalou. This is the movie that the Spanish painter, surrealist painter, Salvador Dali, made with Luis Buñuel. He is the Spanish filmmaker, the Spanish surrealist filmmaker. And this is the movie where they were actually, that helped them get admitted into the Surrealist Hall of Fame, I guess, into the Special Surrealist Club. With this movie, they were now pronounced as surrealists. You know, this was kind of like their admission essay. Un Chien Andalou has no plot. You know, there is not really a theme in it. And the movie is based on dream logic. And what I mean by dream logic is that it was actually dreamt up by Luis Buñuel, and I'm actually going to read a little bit from a book entitled The Persistence of Memory, a biography of Dali by Meredith Etherington Smith. And this is page 94. In a letter to Pepin Bello written that January, Buñuel told his friend that he was going to spend a couple of weeks with Dali and figures to collaborate on some filmic ideas. By February 10th, Buñuel wrote again to Bello, telling him that he and Dali were more united than ever. We have worked together to make a stupendous scenario, quite without precedent in the history of the cinema. We were going to call it El Marista de la Balista, the Marist of the Crossbow. But for the moment, it is provisionally entitled Dangereux de se pencher en dehors, Dangerous to Lean In. We had to look for the plotline. Dali said to me, I dreamed last night of ants swarming around in my hands. And I said, good Lord, and I dreamed that I had sliced somebody or other's eye. There's the film. Let's go and make it. So they wrote this film, the short film, Un Chien Andalou, in 6 days, based on this dream logic, based on their dream. So they incorporated it into this movie. And yes, they had this really creep. I mean, think of Luis Buñuel. Think of Salvador Dali. His paintings and the creepy stories you hear about him. This is a weird guy, and so they created a movie that is twisted. Though there is no underlining thing, though there is no story to it, it's a movie you have to watch. Last time I checked, it was on Netflix. You can watch it on there. It's only like 13, 15 minutes. It's definitely worth watching. I mean, it features ants coming out of a hand, just really creepy stuff like that. The woman getting penetrated with something. You see a woman, and up close, you see a razor, a guy with a razor. He's holding open her eye, and he cuts the eyeball open. And this freaked people out and created so much controversy. People were weirded out by it. And that is kind of what Salvador Dali wanted to achieve. However, now, over the years especially, this movie is touted as a masterpiece because nothing else like this has ever been done at that time in 1929. So, my theme, woman getting penetrated by something, it is a razor. My next movie is Wes Craven's first film of The Last House on the Left from 1972. This isn't just a horror movie. It's more of a exploitation flick. You watch a horror movie now, and the twist ending isn't, you know, it's your best friend under the mask, you know, like Scream. The twist ending nowadays is that it's more of like a psychological, can't help it, I have an issue sort of twist ending. Like somebody is a psychotic person. You know, it's not as like dreamlike, like Psycho, where you're able to, you know, say, okay, well, I'm watching a movie. These movies, the director, like Wes Craven for this one, he made it feel like your daughter was kidnapped. Your daughter or your child or you, I mean, or the victim, or you are the victim. You can relate to this victim getting raped and nearly murdered, but watching your friend die. And then the father catching, you know, finding the child and then realizing that the people that did this to your daughter or your child, they're at your house. You know, you let them stay at your house because you thought they actually needed help. You didn't know the reason why. And so you take it upon yourself to defend your daughter and to brutally massacre these guys. So it, not only is it a horror movie or a slasher flick, you get the horror from it being exploitive because nothing was ever really made like this where it could push buttons in a more theatrical way. I mean, this is more theatrical than it was underground due to its subject matter. And also, you actually have some really good performances from this movie. The controversy obviously stems from the violence of the rape that takes place in the movie where you graphically see this girl getting... I mean, you don't obviously see this stuff. It's not a porno. But it nearly crosses the line at times. Not necessarily by the action itself, but the implied action or the implied dialogue that you know what is absolutely going to happen to her. So I mean, it's an interesting movie. They did a remake here a few years ago, back in 2008, 2009, which I thought was really good as well. What is this girl getting penetrated with? That would be knives. Yes. So Wes Craven's Last House on the Left. My third and final movie is the classic family film from 1972. It's the American pornographic film written and directed by Gerald Damiano, Deep Throat. That's right. No, I would not take your kids to see this movie. Or even my parents. It would be awkward. I mean, why do that when you can just watch it on YouTube? Or probably not YouTube, but, you know, just Google it. You'll probably find it. This movie, the plot is pretty simple. I guess more so complex for porno. On Wikipedia here, they say that the plot is a sexually frustrated woman, played by Linda Lovelace, asks her friend, Dolly Sharp, for advice on how to achieve an orgasm. After a sex party proves no help, Helen recommends that Linda visit a doctor, played by Harry Reams, and this doctor discovers that Linda's clitoris is located in her throat.
Open your mouth. Open your mouth wider. Wider. Well, there it is, you little bugger. There it is.
What?
Your clitoris. It's deep down in the bottom of your throat. Now, Miss Lovelace. Listen, having a clitoris deep down in the bottom of your throat is better than having no clitoris at all.
That's easy for you to say. Suppose your balls were in your ear.
But then I could hear myself coming. Miss Lovelace, listen, we have the problem solved. All we have to do now is find the solution.
Like what?
Well, like deep throat.
Deep what?
Throat. Have you ever taken a penis all the way down to the bottom of your throat?
No. I try, but I choke.
Oh, well, now, my dear, it's a matter of discipline. You have to learn to relax the muscles. You have to regulate your breathing to the movement of your head.
You make it sound so easy.
Well, it is. Try it. You'll like it.
Well, what have I got to lose?
Come, you try it with me.
Basically, after that, you don't give a shit about what the plot is, because that is kind of like the main thing about this movie. That is why people went in droves to go see this in the 70s, because this movie was showing in normal run theaters. It wasn't put in a triple X, you know, sex theater. No, this was shown at like your local, you know, down the road theater, where originally you'd go and watch, I don't know, a Abbott and Costello movie. No, you'd be watching a woman give a deep throat and achieve a rocket ship-like orgasm while she's blowing a very hairy, scrawny man. It's only 61 minutes long, so it was intended to be a comedy. You know, it has some highly, I guess what they say, tongue-in-cheek dialogue and songs and fireworks going off and bells ringing during orgasms. Yeah, so it's interesting. So obviously this woman is getting penetrated by a hairy, large, erect penis. And that is my 3 squared. Deep Throat, The Last House on the Left, and Un Chien Andalou as my favorite controversial movies.
Right on, right on. Okay, well, next week we are going to be doing a masterpiece discussion regarding the Hollywood Reporter article, UCLA Diversity Study Blasts Hollywood as Woefully Out of Touch. That's right, folks. On screen and off, minorities and women are drastically underrepresented, even at a cost to ratings and box office, according to a new report which targets talent agencies, Oscars, and Emmys, among others. So we're going to go over the gist of that entire article and then give our perspectives on it and hopefully have some engaging discussion as well. And that's what we're going to be doing for next week. So I suppose it's time to hit the last segment, is it not, sir?
That is correct.
Then let's do it, folks. Here we go. The movies. Yes, the movies. Okay, folks, we had Bronson, Europa Report, and FDR, American Badass. All Netflix flicks, all the time. Where do you want to start, sir?
Let's go with Europa Report.
Europa Report. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this here is the 2013 science fiction film directed by Sebastian Cordeau with a worldwide cast consisting of Christian Carmago, Anna Maria Marnica, Michael Nyqvist, Daniel Wu, Carolina Widra, and Charlton Copley. This is a found footage film. It's not as bad as it sounds, because for people like me who are not the biggest fans of found footage, you see that and you're immediately like, oh. This is from a static perspective of security cameras, so there is no one actually bouncing up and down, jostling shit, and you're like, what the fuck is actually happening on the screen? Nope, that is a absolute minimum in this. They do it from the point of view of cameras located on the spaceship / space station, and of course inside astronaut helmets and what have you.
T-minus 10, 9, 8.
Good morning. We are all very excited to be here today. This really is a new first step for mankind.
I would hope we keep looking for the answers to those really tough questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? And are we alone?
Internal cam check is a go.
Our craft was heading for a moon of Jupiter, known as Europa.
Yeah, my boy's gonna be 6 when I see him again.
So proud of you.
Oxygen is flowing, we're good.
Commencing egress. In the Navigator zone.
Prep for orbital transfer. We
are clear of Jupiter's orbit.
Pitching for power descent. Ladies and gentlemen, hold on. Here we go.
I can't believe I'm here. This is incredible.
Our best hopes of success lies under the ice.
Let's go for a swim. You hear that?
Are you guys seeing this? It's beautiful.
Come back to the ship now.
I want to see if it's reacting to my lights. I'm going to turn them off.
Compared to the breadth of knowledge yet to be known, what does your life actually matter?
No one at home knows we're alive.
Find a way. We have to.
We got a problem.
It's everywhere. Close it off.
I thought I was trying to do something great for mankind. I always said it was worth the risk.
I'll get you out of this.
Talk to me!
Forgive me.
This movie has been praised by many different NASA-type agencies for depicting the realities of living in space. They are apparently very, very faithful. Not 100% naturally, but very faithful to the realities of conditions of living for astronauts, and also how astronauts behave, and of course, the actual protocols that they must follow. And this particular one is taking place. This particular movie is taking place in. I guess I want to say, definitely latter part of the 21st century, if not into the 22nd century. And they are sending the first manned space mission to Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter. And the film takes place as a recounting of the actual events, and then they intersperse that with news footage of the actual CEO of the corporation in charge of the mission, and then the actual footage itself. And they are going there to basically see if there's any life, and also to just see if there's truly water out there, what's actually on the surface, and all scientific exploration, and then, of course, what actually happens when they get there. This movie clocks in at 89 minutes, and I gotta say, this movie really and truly surprised me. I was not expecting a lot from this film, which I guess in this particular instance helped, because I really did find myself enjoying it. Now, there are a couple of... It's kind of documented like a thriller, and it's not so much a thriller per se as it is just good science fiction telling a really interesting story. And to that extent, you could say it is like a thriller. But for me, given that the story is a more of a narrative-driven experience, and then, of course, combined with the found footage aspect, I gotta say that it's not as much of a thriller as it just kind of is an intense sci-fi experience, I think is the best way to put it. The acting is really well done overall. It's given that the pace of the story is driven so much by the writing, I gotta give some props to the writer here. Screenplay was done by Philip Gallot. I hope I'm saying that right. The only problem that I found was that the elements of the thriller portion of this story really feel forced. Really, really feel forced. Like they're just trying to scare you when it doesn't have to be scary. The content of the movie is enough to just drive it. And I really felt that they were just trying too hard to be scary, to be intense, when they could have just let the story run its course on its own. And then, of course, given the found footage aspects, that's where I said they don't do the shaking thing. Well, they do it, instead of that, they do this kind of multiple screen layout such that your eyes are confused because you can't focus on any one particular camera. And they do that several times throughout the film. And that, to me, really kind of detracts from it. They could have, instead, just continued with the focus of the actual cameras themselves and utilized the cinematography instead to just simply narrow the focus of whatever it was that they wanted you to look at, instead of trying to like confuse you, which then puts you in kind of a little bit of a, you know, more of an intense state. All in all, gonna give this movie 4 stars, a surprising 4 stars for me, really. I really did find that I liked this movie, and I would say that it is definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Matt pretty much on every aspect. It was simple, and it was very entertaining, and it was good sci-fi, definitely. There's one moment in the movie where I thought it kind of went down the same... Although it was executed well, and it was a great scene, and it was a beautiful scene of the movie, I just thought it kind of went down the familiar sci-fi path, especially stuff with the movie Sunshine, which was directed by Danny Boyle there in 2005, I think. That's one of my favorite more modern sci-fi movies. A couple moments it felt like I've kind of seen it before, but again, that was just, you know, a couple scenes out of this entire movie. And the movie is very engaging, and I enjoyed the how kind of fluid it was, and the inclusion of actual music. Bear McCreary, who did the score for the movie, he also did the score for the newer Battlestar Galactica. And this guy is an excellent composer, and he is one of the many glorious gifts to the TV world, because he will compose beautiful music. And it just really added to the movie. And if you were just listening to just silence and panicking and people just freaking out, it would have been a different experience. And I think the music, the inclusion of this great music, definitely helped out the storytelling and the progression of the movie to really keep you entertained. And of course, there are those silent moments for sure, but the music just kind of like creeps in and just really adds to various scenes. I actually forgot that I was watching a found footage movie quite a few times throughout it. I mean, it wasn't until they switched to like a news crew, camera crew, you know, shot where you actually see all the text on the bottom of the screen, because usually it's just a monitor and you kind of see stuff on the screen, but eventually you get used to looking past it. And yeah, the movie just kind of has you on the edge of your seat in a very pure sort of way. A really good story. Again, you just kind of forget, because the special effects aren't absolutely perfect, but they are still believable, and they do not detract from the movie. So it's really good, so I'm glad we watched it. I gave this one 4 out of 5.
On, right on. Where would you like to go from here, sir? We've got Bronson and FDR, American Badass.
Let's do Bronson.
All right, we're going to save the best for last, are we? You probably couldn't hear the sarcasm there. My bad. Anyway, Bronson. Yes, 2008 British Bronson, 2008 British fictionalized biographical psychological drama film. Now, that seems to be a lot of stuff going on in there. It is actually based on the life of a guy by the name of Charles Bronson. No, not the actor. This is about a guy who is... He's actually renamed Charles Bronson. His actual given name is Michael Gordon Peterson. And this movie is directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, and it is starring Tom Hardy. And good God, you've seen Tom Hardy. You think you've seen Tom Hardy? Wait till you see him in this movie. Jesus Christ, he's a scary motherfucker. But he's awesome. This is the movie that totally turned me on to him as an actor. I was just completely blown away by this movie. And it was just such a pleasure to get to watch this movie again for myself. And it's basically him narrating his own life story. He's been in prison for the vast majority of his life and known for his extreme violent tirades, I guess would be a good idea to say. And he actually has supporters, just like any major prisoner gets, especially those with degrees of publicity. But I mean, it just really is such a fascinating story that he tells, and the cinematography is fantastic in this movie. The acting is really, really well done, because Tom Hardy has to carry the movie virtually by himself. But it's just as fun to watch his victims or his compatriots, as it may be, depending on what's happening in the film, as it is to watch him. And I really, really love how the director was able to pull that stuff out from the source material and put it out for you to just be enjoyed in this manner.
I will now reenact what I like to call What Happens When Murder Goes Wrong. When do I go back? Now, now, Mr. Peterson, we aren't going to start up all that silliness again, are we? Listen, Nursey, I just want to know when my trial is and when I head back to the slammer, right? Wrong, Mr. Peterson. Now, let's not play silly buggers, eh? I'll just have to pop you in the body with one of my special potions. When's my trial? No. Mr. White recovered, dear. There's no trial. Isn't that wonderful? However, you are being moved.
Well.
Yes, Mr. Peterson. Broadmoor Asylum for the criminally insane.
I deserve to go to prison for what I did.
I want my hotel room back!
Well, I'm sure you'll find yourself some solitary.
For me, I can't say enough good things about it. You've got to check this movie out. 5 stars for me. Hands down. We're done. What do you got for us there, Tim?
Yeah, I'm there with you. It's a great movie. And I love how it's a very twisted film. A sad film. A very disturbing film. But it's super entertaining. And I know I've talked about this before. Or mentioned it at least before in past shows. That I'm kind of over those movies where they try to force you to feel the complete pain of a character, or they try to trick you into feeling or to ganging up on a character without, you know, like letting you choose whether or not you support the character or you don't support the character, but everything is kind of force fed, you know, down your throat, and they make you do something or feel something, feel a specific way. But I love the movies, like Bronson, where the movie is twisted. You don't know whether you like the guy or you don't like the guy. It's weird. You can tell that this guy has some decent qualities. I don't know. But then he doesn't have decent qualities because this guy is an asshole. But he's an asshole in a super entertaining way. A very violent, scary man, but in a very entertaining way. Because one thing that is just interesting about him is that he kidnaps people. Like guards or therapists or whatever, and he ties them up in a room, and he doesn't do anything to, like, he doesn't hurt them. He's not there to kill the people that he kidnaps. Although, actually, now that I'm remembering, though, okay, there's a couple scenes that prove me otherwise. But I was reading something else that one thing he did do, like, if he didn't absolutely hate you, he would just kidnap this person, and he would wait till the guards busted down the door. And then he would proceed to beat the living shit out of them. And not just one guard, but he will beat the shit out of most of the guards until the big one comes in and, you know, knocks him out, or they pull out a needle and inject him with something. What I'm trying to say is that the movie is entertaining, though it is dark and twisted. It has some comedic moments, and I'm not saying every drama needs to have comedic moments, but it needs to be something like, well, even like, you know, I can even say August Osage County, where the movie is sad, it is really depressing, but the characters are so interesting, and they have a personality. Even if they don't have a personality, they still have a personality, you know, they still have a character. And that's what I like. Though it is a drama, and you do feel sad, or you want to feel sad, there's still a likability to the movie overall. And that's another reason why I really like, you know, like Martin Scorsese, because he can really achieve the same thing. So I give this one 4.5 out of 5. It was great. I can't believe I waited this long to have watched it.
Right on, right on. Okay, well then, last but not least, we have FDR. Actually, for me, last and least. American Badass.
When werewolf attacked you. And bit your life.
Oh, shit, goblins!
It released a small stream of... You've got the polio, Frank.
Does my cack still work?
I think the werewolf might have come from Germany.
Motherfucker!
Germany, Italy, Japan, by joining forces.
I say we go to war!
You are reaching to the gas chamber on this one.
I call this the Delano 2000. We must blast their fucking asses!
Let's get wet.
How in the world are we going to storm the beaches of Normandy, take down an entire army of werewolves, and still make it to a French titty bar by last call?
I present Douglas MacArthur, Chief of Staff of the United States Army.
Dougie Mac.
This is Commander Winston Churchill.
This is General Dwight Eisenhower.
Mussolini.
Hitler.
Eleanor Roosevelt.
Albert Einstein, the real jacket.
Shut the fuck up, Einstein!
Player to player, pimp to pimp, I appreciate it.
I'm a motorcycle of death. I ain't got no sidecar.
Damn you, Frank!
We have nothing to fear, but...
Marco Polio.
Fear itself!
Fuck Polio!
Why was this movie made?
This piece of crap. It's a 2012 action comedy spoof. Directed by Garrett Browith and stars Barry Bostwick and a host of character actors along with Jar Jar fucking Binks.
Oh, did right, he play did he play the black waiter or the servant or whatever?
Yeah, he was the butler, yeah.
That was Jar Jar Binks?
Yes, sir.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Here to throw in some trivia for you.
Wow.
Okay, now, you go into this movie, and you expect that this movie is going to be intentionally bad and intentionally over the top with stupid puns and sex jokes and fart jokes and shit like that, because that's the style of the movie. And I was totally down for that. I saw the trailer back when this movie was first about to be released and everything, and I thought it looked very funny and always meant to get around to seeing it, just never did. So when... I saw that we were going to be watching this, I was like, okay, cool, finally get a chance to check it out. And I sat down to watch this movie, and it starts off ridiculous and somewhat chuckle worthy, and then it just kind of completely goes downhill. It never really finds its ground. It just tries to succeed solely on glorified dick jokes and
a lot of them, a ton.
Yeah, I mean, literally, just over the top. And they're not... The thing is that... Okay, for instance, like, in This Is the End, the dick jokes were funny. The context for the dick jokes really worked, and they were just funny. Here, there is no real context for them. They're just inserting them just for the sake of inserting them, thinking that that's going to be the comedy of the movie. But comedy is timing, and comedy is also context, especially when you're making a spoof. And... The whole idea of Nazi werewolves sounds funny. It does. It sounds funny, but it just is completely executed so fucking badly that it's not even... It's just totally zaps the fun out of it. And then they just don't stop, and they keep up with the stupid sex jokes and stupid dick jokes, but they're not funny. And then the dialogue just seems to kind of drop out of nowhere, and then like, oh, we should make this line funny and screamy and stupid, and then we should try to make this one mock serious, and then we should try to make this one do something different, and you just can't ever follow along. And then even when the plot does start to make a little bit of sense, which again, I understand, it's a stupid over-the-top spoof, but you still need to have certain things in place to keep it funny and to keep it something that you can follow. The penultimate scene of the movie is FDR flying over and killing off the werewolves that are Mussolini and Hitler and everybody. But that's not even the best scene. The best scene is when he gets his hot dog quivering legs jacked off by his secretary. And that was the only time I laughed, like actually laughed at the scene. And then it goes away. And then you have Kevin Sorbo in a brief cameo as Abe Lincoln. And I thought that was going to be good. And it started off kind of good. And then, nope, it dropped off too. And then the movie just literally kind of ends. It doesn't even end well. It just kind of ends. And you're kind of left like, Why the fuck does the secretary pull out hot dogs? And then that's it. That's it. I did not like this movie at all. Even given the subject matter. I knew going in that this was going to be a stupid, dumb spoof. And I thought, and I was like, okay, cool. I like these kinds of movies. I thought it would be okay. And no. Terrible, 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 terrible movie. Hated it. 1 star. I'm not going to give it 0 stars because I did chuckle at the beginning and then I actually laughed in it. So I'm not going to give it 0 stars, but I am giving it 1. It's dangerously close to a half star.
I don't know why the hell this movie was even made. I do know why. And judging by reading the credits and how many times the word fuck was used, especially with like the thank yous, and one of them said, for all you... I'm saying it as how I remember it, so I'm not actually quoting it. But it was something in the vein of, all you fuckers who motherfucking independent films, you know, thank you, or this is for all you fuckers, and just all this stuff. And you're reading all that, and you're kind of getting an idea of the douchebags that were probably behind the making of this movie. You know, I mean, I shouldn't say douchebags, because I don't know. But this movie feels like it was written by a adolescent douchebag, because so many versions of the same joke is littered throughout this movie. And I'm not just saying various versions of a single joke. No, various versions of every single fucking joke that they have that differentiates from one another variation in the movie. It's just the same thing throughout the entire thing. I mean, there's so many references to his shriveled up hot dog legs. It's stupid. And on top of that, they have all this other stupid... They go to the factory worker, and then they all end up quoting, like, through their dialogue, living on a prayer.
God bless you guys, huh?
Hey, keep laughing, boys. You think God blessed Tommy?
Hold on, fellas. Who's Tommy?
Tommy used to work on the docks. Union's been on strike. Down on his luck. It's tough.
So tough. What happened to him?
Got so depressed he tried to off himself.
And who's taking care of him?
His wife, Gina. Gina works the diner all day. Working for...
Come over here. Sit on Uncle Frankie's lap. You know, the devil knows gonna fix this shit. You guys are the salt of the earth, the real people who make this country run. And I am not going to leave you to live on a prayer. Yeah!
Yeah! Yes! You know, I mean, some of it is funny. And I mean, again, I would lie if I said that I didn't laugh at certain moments. I was mainly grossed out about the leg jacking off thing. But there were other moments where I either laughed or chuckled, you know. But it wasn't that often, especially towards the end. The movie was just getting more annoying than anything else. And I can't even remember what I actually laughed at, only like the one thing I was grossed out at. I mean, you'd be fooled because you'd see that, oh, Barry Boswick is in this movie. Kevin Sorbo has a bit role. There are at least 3 other people in this movie that you will recognize. I forget the woman's name who was in a lot of Farley Brothers movies. She plays Eleanor Roosevelt. She was in Kingpin as the nasty, horny landlord. She was in There's Something About Mary. She's been in a lot of stuff, so there are like 3 or 4 or 5 noticeable people in this movie. And you just wonder, like, did they waste all their money doing this movie, or were they doing a favor for somebody's dad? I don't know. Because this movie is ridiculous. Yeah. Even if you're watching this, like, while you're inebriated, I mean, if you're strung out on heroin and you cannot move for, like, 12 hours, and this movie happens to come on the TV... Your heroinified ass would make every attempt you possibly can to change the channel or to turn off the TV. It's that bad. So I just can't rate this movie because it's like there are parts of it I enjoyed. I mean, though they were very few, but most of it I just did not like. It was just trying way too hard to be like Zucker in Airplane and Naked Gun. So this is another can't rate for me.
You're going to have to give it a rating, or I'm going to say that you rated it as a 1, like me. You got to have an opinion. I mean, come on.
Well, okay.
Was it okay? Was it less than okay? Did you hate it?
Well, no, because here's my logic with this. It's like, okay, so this movie was trying to be like The Room, you know? Like something that is so bad that it's entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so like if you watch a movie that is so bad that it's actually entertaining, how would you rate that? You know, you can either say that, oh, well, you
enjoyed it. It depends,
because
if it was intentionally trying to be bad, so bad that it's entertaining, then it becomes entertaining and it becomes good. So you could then say, oh, well, this is a 3-star movie because I liked it, because even though it is a, quote, bad movie, they did that on purpose to make it entertaining. So then it succeeded. Here is a bad movie trying to be bad, or so bad that it's good, and it flopped. It sucks. And so, therefore, not only can you not say that you liked it, or you can't even say that you appreciated it for what it was trying to do, because it was just bad. So you're saying that it did not meet the merits of so bad it's good. So therefore, I would have to say that you at least did not like the movie. So I'm thinking that's got to be 2 stars.
0 stars. I'm going to give it 0.
Wow. We've got our first 0-star rating of the year. And I didn't give it. Okay, cool. Wow. So there you go. What a fantastic SLS cast rating of 0.5 star. I think Roger Ebert would be proud. Okay, well, that's going to end the movies for us. Next week, we've got, again, another Netflix group of movies, because don't worry, with all the superhero shit coming next month, we're going to be taking you to the movies a lot. We've got Stolen, Sightseers, and Stand-Up Guys. Those are going to be the movies for next week. And I believe that leads us to the spiel, does it not, sir?
Spiel on.
Very good, then. All right. The music, as always, that you're listening to has been provided to us by Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at myspace.com, reverbnation.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. As for us, well, of course, we're still the SLS cast, and you can check us out at slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @theslscast. You can go to Facebook and search the SLS cast there, and of course, subscribe to us on iTunes and like us on Twitter. Like us on Twitter? What the fuck is liking us? Like us on Stitcher. Favorite us there too while you're at it. So that's all, and that's that. And until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Helen Mirren, I get to say this. Everyone wants to be a movie star or a model to be in the papers, but few realize just what hard work it is getting up early and so on.
I agree with her. Oh my god, you have to wake up early on movies. Take care, guys. Talk to you next week.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, @theslscast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.